Welcome to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas, brought to you by the Independent Institute, my show that tries to bring a uniquely rational perspective to important issues facing our society today. Today's guest, Dr. Robert Robbins, or as I and others know him, Bobby Robbins. Bobby is the President Emeritus of University of Arizona, where he served as president from 2017 to 2024. He previously served as the president and CEO of the Texas Medical Center. Before that, the chair of the Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery at Stanford University Medical Center, where he was the inaugural director of the Stanford Cardiovascular Institute. Bobby is currently my colleague at Stanford's Hoover Institution, where he's serving as a visiting distinguished fellow. Bobby and I have a conversation about some of the most important issues facing us today involving the college campus, including free speech and its limits, the impact of government funding, merit-based admissions, and the friction between welcoming young students from other countries and the United States taxpayer funding and the interests of the United States. Thanks for joining us and stay tuned. Okay, Bobby Robbins, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Great to have you on the show. And there's so many things happening on college campuses. I thought you'd be the perfect person to speak to since you just had a pretty long tenure, at least in terms of college presidents, as that goes, and a very successful one at University of Arizona. And I'd love to have your perspective on all kinds of things happening, and maybe you're freer to speak about them since you don't have that position anymore. The first thing that we see, and I'll get right into it, about what's on the front page on college campuses, one of the things anyway, sort of highlighted by the fact that we have a bunch of wars going on in the world, sadly, and we have a very active president of the United States who is interested in using the leverage of funding on the operations, in his view, to fix them, of higher education. So I want to talk about sort of the topic of free speech on campus. And, you know, I think we see it in the frame of anti-Semitism right now, or the sort of Israel hot button issue of the war in the Middle East and what's going on. And that it's sort of the big issue there is what are the limits that exist on a college campus on free speech, on protests, and when is that exceeded in your view?
Yeah, it's a really good question to start with, Scott. I'm really proud of University of Arizona and all the universities that are governed by the Arizona Board of Regents. We actually, all three had green fire ratings for upholding free speech on our campuses, which is so important. But free speech means free speech. And, you know, if you don't like it, it doesn't mean that you can intimidate or try to squelch the voices of people. So I think free speech is free speech. And of course, you know, you get into what is hate speech, and then we can get into protests. I think they're obviously constitutionally, we would support people's right to demonstrate and to protest, but it has to be within a set of guide rails that is within the law. And when violence happens, or for instance, you know, I can remember watching the UCLA and the Columbia protest, ours were less intense. But the fact that protesters were inhibiting students from moving freely on the campus and even going to their classes is unacceptable. So there's a whole range of things that involves that question of free speech. But obviously, you know, we support the First Amendment and we support that on our college campuses. When it goes too far, I think that you have to have the fortitude to make tough decisions that may be unpopular, and you need the support of your governing boards and when you go through those kind of processes. But obviously we're very supportive of free speech on campuses and everywhere.
Right. I mean, the tricky part, of course, comes not necessarily with the legal definitions, because the campus is a specific environment that has a code of conduct that is not necessarily just the law, as you well know. And the second part is that, I mean, there are many parts of this. Well, another part really is what you mentioned briefly, which is physically blocking passage of students, taking over buildings is sort of in that world probably exceeding limits. But then there's something that's a little more nuanced, which is intimidating other students. Of course, I think everyone knows or should know that there is no law against what some people call hate speech. That's not a legal issue. Hate speech is not somehow different from other speech.
Correct.
On the other hand, you're on a college campus. Intimidation of students, whether legal or not in the pure sense of a law, is different. And how do you navigate that?
Yeah, I think it comes down to, place and time, and the deans of students and the presidents of universities have difficult decisions to adjudicate these case by case, classroom by classroom. I think until President Trump was reelected, I think there's been a chilling effect on conservative voices in the classroom, on the college campuses, and I think almost any campus you would go to, some not so much as others, but I think that when there are complaints that come to the dean of students, the dean of students has to adjudicate, as you mentioned, the code of conduct. And unfortunately, that oftentimes takes a long time to get to the adjudication of these matters. So it's complicated, but I think that each campus has its own culture. Each campus has a shared governance voice. And sometimes they can be more intense than in other places.
Mm-hmm. Did you notice, you mentioned the fire ratings of campuses, I think, and
yes,
your school. What was the, did you specifically have to deal with that? And did you sort of focus on that? Because I think it's undeniable that the vast majority of college and university campuses have a liberal bent, a leftist bent, not a classical liberal bent, but a leftist bent in the United States. And that's been going on for decades, maybe 50 years. I don't know. But did you have to grapple with that as president at University of Arizona?
Not as much as I thought I was going to have to. The Board of Regents, spoke with each of our presidents, and the Faculty Senate at University of Arizona actually gave a vote to approve the University of Chicago approach to free speech. And, there's a process to go through to get evaluated by FIRE. And I was pleased that it wasn't as contentious as I thought it might be.
Were there faculty members, if I may ask, during your tenure that were, first of all, complaining about or indicating that they were sort of self-canceling or the direct object of cancel culture because of more conservative viewpoints? Or, separate question, were there faculty hires that were difficult to get through or impossible to get through because they were out of the mainstream, more leftist side of the equation?
No, I don't think, to answer your second question first, that there was a lot of problems with more left-leaning faculty members. As a matter of fact, right before I arrived at University of Arizona, Noam Chomsky was hired. Now he's an interesting voice. Obviously he had spent almost his whole career in Boston at MIT, But when he came to campus, you know, I heard from some conservative lawmakers, one of which lived, I think, near Nome. And, you know, it's a continuum. And I said, you know, at the bottom of that continuum is libertarianism, and you're probably not as far apart as you think you are. But Nome was probably the most high-profile person that I heard about, but he was hired before I got there. And then the first question, there were certainly faculty members that were very strong and outspoken in their conservative views, and they were definitely canceled, many mm-hmm. cases.
I mean, this is really, to me, the biggest danger. There are two of the so-called cancel culture of differing opinions. A, the universities are the centers for the free exchange of ideas. And if you're not fulfilling that, you can't possibly teach students critical thinking, because you can't, by definition, you cannot learn critical thinking without hearing more than one side.
I agree.
Right? I mean, this is obvious, shouldn't even have to be said. But the second part is also, we're teaching, I feel, and I'll say at my own institution at Stanford University, but it's not the only one, the behavior of faculty and the cancel culture, or the drowning out, or the, whatever you want to call it, of so-called conservative views or unwanted views, is teaching the wrong message to young people. And of course, all of us have raised our children to respect authority. Kids should and do have respect for their professors. And these are modeling behaviors that these people, the professors, are modeling behaviors that are really harmful. You know, I don't know what you think about that, and if you even saw that.
Oh, and I completely agree with everything you just said, Scott. And I've seen it in person on many occasions. I think that, you know, especially for tenured professors, or I would say for any professor, it is an incredible privilege and honor to be able to work at a university, maybe one of the highest callings I can think of in service in life. But as you point out, you have to have a balanced view about what, you know, both sides. I don't know much about the law, but, you know, I'm told that in law school, you learn to try to make the argument of the other side, so you're prepared for that when it comes. So I think that it's, I think it is good, it's healthy, it's intellectually stimulating, and to hear all viewpoints in an open and transparent way. So I think that's lacking in many cases, but some of the really good professors certainly adhere to those guiding principles.
Right. Again, with the privilege, as you point out, of having that sort of position, there is a massive responsibility, because, you know, what I think, I don't want to overstate it, but it's very true that, in my view, you know, the college campus is where a lot of young people mature, and at least that's part of the process. We can't model the wrong behaviors, and I feel it's very sad, it's tragic when the universities don't fulfill that mission and instead try to create advocacy groups and things like this. And I think this is one of the problems with America's colleges and universities today, is that a lot of campuses, the intent of the education has been to create advocates rather than to impart information and critical thinking. I mean, has that changed in your view, or has that happened, or am I way off base here?
No, I think you're spot on. I do see some hope for the future. You know, I think that you know, what? Why would one go to college? One goes to college to learn new knowledge, to learn the skills that will prepare you for whatever field you choose to live after your college life, and to be successful. And I think, you know, the focus on a broad-based education with these fundamental guiding principles of critical thinking, collaborative communication skills. These are the things that employers look for. And I think oftentimes I was told, well, we're not trying to teach life skills. We're not a trade school. But that's why individuals go to college, to expand their knowledge base, learn from others from different viewpoints and cultures from all over the world. All of our major universities have students from all over the world. And I think that it's beneficial and healthy to learn those things. But as you point out, if you're just getting one side of the story, we're doing a great disservice to our students.
Now, one of the processes that is involved in this, of course, is beyond the book learning that you can do. It's not just the knowledge. It's the working in groups. It's the conflict resolution. It's the socialization. All of these things in college are important, just like they were, you know, in K through 12, of course. And that's one of the reasons why in-person school is so important and beneficial. And I want to point out, and this is written about in The Atlantic, that you were the first president of a major public university to reopen classes in person during the COVID fiasco, I'll call it, of 2020. I'd like to talk a little bit about that experience, because you announced this back in April of 2020, right in the beginning of this whole madness of shutdowns, that you understood how important it was to reopen in the fall. And being in California, of course, and being at Stanford in California, of course, the opposite happened here. The most protracted school closures in the country were in California, frankly. But let's talk a little bit about what was happening then and what your experience was then and how that was met when you said that.
Yeah, well, I had strong support from our governor. I'll go back in history just to set the context for this answer. I was at the Pac-12 basketball conference championship tournament in Las Vegas, and it was Wednesday, March 11th, when Rudy Gobert tested positive for COVID, and you saw the Utah Jazz stadium emptied as they canceled the game. So all the presidents and chancellors in the Pac-12 had to make a decision: were we going to go forward with the Pac-12 conference? And we decided to, of course, suspend it, to cancel it. And I called my provost and said, we were on spring break, parenthetically, and we were able in 10 days, with a lot of hard work from all the professors, the staff, particularly our IT staff, which were phenomenal, we were able to go back to classes after spring break, which is only 10 days later, and hold classes, albeit virtually. But we set down a marker to say that even in the summer, and certainly by the fall of 2020, we were going to have in-person classes. Now, that I was met with a lot of resistance about that.
I can imagine that.
Yeah, but I had a strong governor, Governor Ducey, a strong board of regents who supported me. And I had Rich Carmona, who was the 17th Surgeon General of the United States, who served under George W. Bush, 43. And he managed the entire relocation of hundreds of thousands of people out of New Orleans to Houston during Katrina. He happens to be one of the, he'd been a professor at University of Arizona for over 35 years and was a driving force in setting up our outstanding School of Public Health. And he's a vascular surgeon trained up the road from us at Stanford at UCSF. Mm. And he's just a tremendous individual. And he came in and I appointed him to run our COVID response. And so he did something that he obviously had learned. He was a medic and a special forces soldier in Vietnam, and he instituted an instant command system at the university. And you can imagine that I was accused of militarizing our campus, but it worked very, very well. And we knew that We had to educate the public and say, you know, you need to wash your hands, you need to cover your face, you need to distance, and just to make people comfortable enough to get them back. But we were threatened. Rich and I were threatened by certain faculty members that they would go to the Arizona Board of Medical Licensure and ask for our license to be suspended or revoked because we were causing harm and violating the Hippocratic Oath. But we powered through it. I mean, it was remarkable. And we provided services to the whole Southern Arizona community, vaccinated about 300,000 people during that time. And I was confident we could do this and do it safely. Not one person was hospitalized. We had one student who had sickle cell anemia or sickle cell trait, I think it was. And out of the abundance of caution, she was put in the hospital and observed for a couple of days. That's it.
Just for observation. Yeah, I mean, this is one of the untold stories of the whole propaganda, frankly, because, when I was in the White House, I was compiling and showing the data with some outside helpers, but showing the data to President Trump about these tens of thousands of cases, so-called, on campuses during the summer, late summer of 2020. And this was highlighted by the media every day. There were explosion of cases, and it was frightening the public. And meantime, there were essentially zero, almost zero hospitalizations and zero deaths from tens of thousands of so-called cases because they were just testing positive in people. Right. They didn't even know they had the illness. That's how low symptom or even asymptomatic people were that were low risk, the young healthy people. And yet this was really inciting a lot of fear. This was sort of, again, like I don't even want to think about that era because it was so disturbing and frustrating to say the truth. Yet people were so refractory to the truth because, fear causes irrational thinking.
Yeah, and there was, but it was weaponized. I mean, there was an attack on us. But I look back on it saying, I get people all the time, especially out-of-state parents, who said, I'm not going to pay out-of-state tuition for my student to sit at home on their computer. They need to be back on campus. They want to be back on campus. It's healthier. And so I'm proud of what we did at the University of Arizona. And Rich Carmona is, he's one of my heroes, and he is a very pragmatic, very wise individual who had a lot of experience. And we proved the theory of the case that we could have classes in person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a slam dunk, good common sense, and knowing basic biology and all the other things about risk and the destruction of isolating kids, we saw, and don't need to spend a lot of time on this except to say it's one of the black marks on American society, what was done to young healthy people when they were isolated from their social networks, which are a lot more important to younger people than they are to people like you and me, probably.
I think, Scott, it's also important for the elderly too, especially if they're isolated. So,
The very elderly, in fact, and that's a good point. I don't want to gloss over that because we saw a lot of people in nursing homes isolated from their families, and I do believe, and it's sort of difficult to prove, but there is data there that the older people in nursing homes started dying from despair as well, from the isolation. Very sad. I want to talk about, we started to talk about the issue of free speech and I brought up the point and I think it's important that the leverage, if you want to use that term, of the federal government on a campus in terms of what it does operationally, and respecting free speech and all that. On the other hand, I think we do have to recognize that it's the U.S. taxpayers who are funding quite a bit of college and university campuses despite them being called private versus public. And I, you know, we could talk, as you know, a lot more about University of Arizona than anybody, but I looked up some facts, and they have there's a couple things I want to mention and ask about. Number one, you know, it's a state school, but there's a lot more funding from the federal government than the state government. So it's not really true that only Arizona residents are so-called footing the bill to support a state university. It's not true. It's the federal taxpayer. It's everybody who pays taxes. And, you know, you did quite a bit on raising money. It's remarkable. You raised a couple billion dollars, I think the number is, in your campaign that began when you started in 2017. But so first, let's talk about what your role was, not your role, but your thoughts as president of a university, and the mix between the responsibility to the federal government and there's pluses and minuses to that.
Yeah, well, as you correctly point out, you know, we had not one but two medical schools and a nursing school and a public health school and pharmacy school, but when I arrived at Arizona, the largest funding, and it was odd. I don't know that there were, there's another example of a university, major research university, who had more national science funding than NIH funding. But regardless, all of that money comes from the federal government. And right. we have to be good stewards and be accountable and spend that money responsibly. But it's a really important point. Not only for the institution, but for the community, because there's an economic benefit to having a large research university in your community. So I think, you know, obviously you've got the right inclination about this. It's not just the taxpayers of the state. And as you point out, much more money came in from the federal government than the state government.
Right. I mean, the University of Arizona has a one of these places, and it's probably in the top 20 or 30 in public universities on their endowment. So they have over $1 billion endowment. Of course, there are some that have $50 billion endowments in the private, in the list of private colleges that we know. But I want to talk about the endowment and the function of the endowment. And I'd like to hear your thoughts on what is the function of the endowment at a place like Arizona, where it had about $1 billion+ in endowment, and then go toward what the function of a $50 billion endowment is at the Harvards of the world.
Yeah, I think that in Arizona's case, all of that money was managed through a separate 501c3 foundation. And the foundation's sole mission is to support the University of Arizona. So when I arrived, I think the endowment was about $575 or $600 million, and we increased it to $1.2 billion. And our research expenditures, the research activity, increased from about $500 million to about $1 billion. So the function of the endowment, most all of those funds that grateful donors who love the University of Arizona give, they're almost all earmarked for donor-specific interests.
They're targeted. They're targeted donations.
Yes. Yeah. So it's not fungible. You know, those assets are not fungible. And you know, there's a small amount that is, but over 95%, certainly 97 or 98% of all those funds are targeted for specific programs. It's not like you can use those to cover operational costs, which you should never do, as a matter of fact. I can remember way back, Scott, when there were strikes by the nurses at Stanford, and they said, well, you've got this huge endowment. Then it wasn't nearly the size it is now. You can just use that money to pay us. It's a really bad bad use of strategic funds to cover operational costs. And I think when John Hennessy and John Etchemendy were in place,
it was at Stanford.
It was smart not to commit to using a lot of the endowment to cover operating costs. Places like Brown, I think, were probably 60 or 70% dependent on their endowment. So that should not be the use of the endowment. It should be for big strategic investments that the university deems appropriate.
Now, but what then you, so okay, and that's totally understanding. I understand that. It's pretty straightforward. But when you get to the point of a $50 billion endowment, and that endowment just goes up, right. It doesn't go down. Right. It's invested wisely, and these guys make a lot of money being the stewards of the investment side of the endowment, as you know, and that's fine. I'm always for people who are good getting paid money. But the point is, from a taxpayer point of view, when a school that is called private, like a Harvard or a Stanford, they still get a massive amount of federal money, federal taxpayer money, because again, the federal government has no money, it's taxpayer money, to paraphrase Margaret Thatcher, it's one of my favorite sayings. So you have a school that has a $50 billion endowment, it never goes down, and yet they keep taking a massive amount of federal taxpayer money, and they think they have no accountability to the taxpayer to boot. So what happens to a, I mean, I think it's, I know there's no real answer to this, but it sort of rubs me the wrong way as a common sense, you know, naive person out there who's a taxpayer, that a school has an accruing a $50 billion endowment that keeps going up, yet they keep having U.S. taxpayers not only support their activities year after year, but also pay up when they want to, quote, forgive student loans. Mm-hmm. And so how does a taxpayer, how does a university president, and maybe you know, this is not necessarily reflective of what you did at Arizona because your endowment was $1 billion. That's a different kind of ball game. What is it? What are your thoughts on what I said? $50 billion endowment keeps going up year after year, yet you keep taking U.S. taxpayer money and somehow feel that you're not accountable to the U.S. federal government / taxpayer.
Well, I think
that's a loaded question. I apologize.
Yeah, but no, I as you well know, I'm eager to discuss that because I think we're finding out our good friend Alan Garber, who was our colleague at Stanford, is now got the task of being the president of Harvard University, and I think they're right. Finding out that there will be accountability. And as much as the $50 billion endowment is huge, and it is, it cannot sustain Harvard without federal money indefinitely, because that number will go down. Because if you're gonna spend money to make up for the billions of dollars, you just think about all of the research and the medical school at Harvard and all the things that are done. I don't think Harvard can, you know, they could probably make it several years, but it's sending the wrong message. And I think this has uncovered one of those mysteries of higher education about how you can continue to build this endowment, but have no accountability to the federal government. Now, with each grant, there's certainly accountability, but I think we're talking about some of these fundamental guiding principles we discussed at the outset. And, you know, Senator Grassley, I can remember Senator Grassley being onto this 30 years ago. He kept harping on how is it possible? It's the exact question you're asking. How is it possible that these institutions can amass these fortunes, in many cases, probably bigger than the reserves of most states? I can tell you from experience in Arizona and certainly Mississippi, mm-hmm. those states don't have reserves of $50 billion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, there is a, you know, I think it's just my perception maybe, but we're sort of, we've lived the last several decades with very little accountability, including, of course, the government itself on how they're spending taxpayer money. Right. And so this sort of, you know, I'm from my parents didn't go to college. I'm from a relatively poor background. So I'm not in this elite class that I've been living in. I'm not aligned with the elites of the world, whatever you want to make of that word. But I do have some resentment toward this idea that the Harvards of the world, and I'm not picking on Harvard specifically, I'm using that in quotes, can take that kind of taxpayer money and sit on $50 billion a year and then are outraged when there's accountability for that money.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And as you well know, I grew up poor in Mississippi, fortunately raised by my maternal grandparents. My grandfather taught community college math for 47 years. And I think when he retired in 1972, he was making $6,800 a year. Mm-hmm. So but neither of us come from the elite class, but we've benefited by being at places like Stanford. And I think these universities, these elite universities like Harvard and Princeton and Penn and Stanford, have been phenomenally successful in advancing scientific discovery and other things. But the fact that now there's someone calling into question these guiding principles we've been discussing about what goes on the campuses and how protesters could take over a campus in the case of Columbia for a short while at mm-hmm. UCLA without any accountability or justice served for how these protesters could get away with that. And, you know, it's cost the leadership of many of these institutions. Their presidents have resigned, and it's put them into a bit of chaos. But I think that the president is right to call these things into question. And I think that, you know, you can continue to fight with him. I don't know if the strategy is just to wait him out because it'll go through the courts forever and he'll be out of office. But I think this is a point in time where there's a big change in attitude. Certainly, if you look at, you know, all these major universities are members of a group called the American Association for Universities, quote, mm-hmm. the leading research institutions of the country. And even before President Trump was reelected, there was polling done continuously by the organization. And there was just not very strong support for certainly these elite universities because of the high debt, not being able to get a job, and didn't come out, with the skills to be able to function in society. So, I don't know what's going to happen. My sense is, though, this is a transformation that is going to last for a long time.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned science, and of course, University of Arizona is really one of the premier places where not only for scientific discovery, but also the sort of focus of the campus to some extent has been a science, a lot of astrophysics and space exploration and things. So under your leadership, that really blossomed. But I wanna talk about it in terms of this idea that the NIH caps on indirect costs become an issue. You and I both have had NIH grants. We understand the process. We understand how the NIH dominates science funding, really to the point where there's some downside to that domination because people change their careers just to focus on getting a grant and therefore doing research that they wouldn't even normally do just to get the grant because you need it for promotion and all these things. But that's not exactly what I think I'd like to talk about. What I really want to talk about is this idea that there are some places that have 60, 70, 80% indirect costs. And a lot of places have roughly 50% indirect costs, which are, for listeners, costs of the grant are determined by what the research costs are. And then there's another 50, 60, 70% added on to cover infrastructure costs, indirect costs of the university. Let me hear your thoughts on that topic. And what do you think is happening with that in terms of the Trump administration?
Well, clearly, the Trump administration is intent on reforming this system. Now, you know, to do it immediately, you can see, I think Ron Daniels in the administration at Johns Hopkins immediately announced some layoffs. Certainly Allen and Harvard have done that, and every institution is doing it, because if you don't have the funds coming in, you're not going to be able to employ those people. I can, you know, one of the big things that we do at the University of Arizona under the East Concourse of our football stadium is we make all of the mirrors for all the giant telescopes in the world. And it employs hundreds of people and benefits the economy. If those NSF and NASA and NIH monies start to diminish, then people are going to lose their jobs and it's going to hurt the communities. But
we're talking about indirect costs. I'd like to hear first for myself as well as the listeners, how is this number arisen at in the university? When you say, okay, we're going to have a 45% indirect cost, I mean, why do some places have 20%? Some places for private foundations accept zero indirect costs on grants. Yet from the taxpayer, some places like Scripps, I think it is in San Diego, if I'm not mistaken, has something like a 90% indirect cost item.
Right. Yeah, I think the American Heart still pays about 10% indirect costs, which for the viewers, it's overhead costs. So it's a chicken and egg thing about, well, are you going to build? I use the Mirror Lab as an exemplar of, you have to have funds to be able to build those kind of facilities to be able to do this work. And that's where the indirect cost to recovery and the overhead costs go, and to pay electricity and depreciation on buildings and all that. I think, you know, 90% is outrageous. I think cutting it back to 15% is going to be problematic. Mm-hmm. My sense is it's going to be probably negotiated with the administration to come in at around 25-30%, which will be a major reduction for a place like Stanford or a place like right. University of Arizona. And we're going to have to relearn how to function without those funds. I do think it'll have somewhat of a chilling effect on our clear world dominance in innovation and discovery. So I'm a little concerned about that.
Yeah, I'm concerned, but I'm also concerned that those numbers are arisen as sort of a lumped on percent without any line item. I mean, there's no real transparency to the calculation. And I think that it's very important that this discussion occurs. What about these indirect costs? We'll see where it ends up. I think you're right. I doubt it'll end up at some arbitrary 15%. I think that was almost, I don't know, but my guess is it's sort of a negotiating tool. Okay, this is my offer. What's your offer? But I would like to see a lot more transparency on the calculation of indirect costs, because it's very simple. I forget who said it, but when you spend other people's money, and meaning when there's no filter on how much money can be requested, the request goes up. And I think, you know, American people work very hard. It's their tax money. The government does not have the money to do that. They're giving people's earned money away. I just think we've lost sight of that as a society. That's my own sort of philosophical belief.
Yeah, and so there will be, you know, you could take the Steve Forbes flat tax approach to this and say there's one indirect cost recovery number, American Heart, 10%. Doesn't matter if you're at Stanford or University of Mississippi. It does cost more to do research in places like Palo Alto than it does in Starkville, Mississippi, for instance. So there's got to be something... there's got to be an understanding of that. But I love your idea. You could take those indirect cost recovery dollars. So for instance, $1 million grant at 50%, you get $1.5 million, $500,000 of it, you have to account for it. here's how much we paid for electricity. Here's how much we paid for equipment, building depreciation, those kind of things. So the president, you know, you've probably told him that. So you may see that coming down the line.
Yeah, we'll see. I think a lot of these things are, as you mentioned, tied up in courts also. And one of the things I found when I was in my 3.5 months in Washington was that the what people call the deep state, which is really a sort of career bureaucratic environment, these people outlast presidents. They outlast administrations. And there is a very, very short timer going on President Trump and his administration. I mean, that's just the reality. And the strategy of, well, let's see, let's tie it up in the courts. And, you know, by the time you turn around, there's a new president in who does these things by executive order and reverses things, which is another sort of a problem, really, is that things are done without any long term substance. It's simply executive order and then it's overturned and we'll see. I mean, this is just a bigger problem. I want to talk about the issue. We talk about the government funding of campus and students and student loans and all this. And then you can sort of segue from that into the idea that student visas and foreign students and the freedom of speech thing ties into this. But what is the policy of universities on taking foreign students, how much of that, you know, there's a lot of questions in this, but how much of that is due to the attraction of having foreign students pay full tuition? I think that's an issue at a place like Stanford. I don't know what it is at a place like Arizona, but it's very complicated. The admission process for foreign students on visas, the idea that it's a privilege to have a student visa, and how does that tie in, and how much of that is an economic side of this?
Well, going back to the discussion on free speech, I think it's very beneficial to have the privilege of being at an institution that has people from all over the world, because you learn about things that you would never be exposed to. But without question, it is a financial driver, and it's very competitive to attract those students to your campus. But, you know, just like in health insurance, just like in healthcare, you know, international patients pay full costs. And oftentimes those costs that are set by a hospital, just like a university, are discounted down to insurance providers. And in our case, certainly the out-of-state students and the international students pay 3 to 4 times more, and that allowed us to keep the cost for in-state students down. So there is clearly a financial motive to get international students to come to your university.
What about the issue of donors, philanthropy from other countries, people who either were alums who are very generous in their donation, or it's certainly a perception, and I don't know how accurate this is, that there's a lot of donations that come in with strings attached for getting kids, family members, countrymen, young people into the college, into the university. Is this something that you grapple with when you're looking at potential philanthropy?
Not as much at the big public universities that are less selective than the privates. Now, for some of them, you know, University of Michigan, which is a little more selective, but you would be surprised. They're not certainly as selective as Harvard and Stanford. But there's a clear pattern that if you give a big enough donation and you're close, your student or whoever it is that you want to be admitted, they get some preferential treatment, no doubt mm-hmm. about it. Because I can remember when John Hennessy first became president, and he wrote, please, all of you loyal Stanford alums and friends of Stanford, stop sending me your letters about how your child or your grandchild or someone you wanted to get into Stanford was valedictorian and had a perfect SAT score and perfect grade point average. We could fill our whole class with those people. but we need to have more diversity in the people that we admit. Not to say it wasn't a meritocracy. You got to be close. But just like the Ivies, if you're a good athlete, you get some consideration for admission. You have to be in striking range, but if your family gives a lot of money, you get a little preferential treatment. Mm-hmm. And that goes on at every big private university.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's just the reality. Although I have switched my own thinking on the sports equivalence of that. My thinking now as I matured, or maybe I haven't matured that much, but I've certainly gotten older, is that sports and excellence in sports is an indicator of something far more important than what I thought when I was a teenager. And that is, to do that, you have to have such focus, such strength of character. It's a long-term endeavor to be the stars, to be the people who really are college level, you know, NCAA Division I level athletes, let alone stars in college. And, you know, I sort of think that's something that has been undervalued by people who look at it as something frivolous or superficial. I actually think I have a lot of respect as I've gotten older for people who are highly accomplished athletes. And I think it should be taken into account beyond the fact that it brings in money to the university, beyond the fact that alums are thrilled when their team goes to the NCAA basketball, you know, I'm aware of Arizona's outstanding basketball program. I went to Illinois for college, and we did beat you in that NCAA tournament 20 years ago in the biggest comeback. But that's a separate topic.
There's a whole podcast on the future of college athletics. But I totally agree with you, Scott. Jeff Immelt played tackle at Dartmouth, and when he was CEO of GE, he would always come up and talk to the team when Buddy Tevens went back to Dartmouth to be the coach. And he said, you know, Fortune 50 companies are looking for Stanford and Ivy League athletes because it teaches you discipline, time management, teamwork, that you can take coaching, and you know, you do all that on top of doing the rigorous academic work. So right. I think
so
it's
many
really
positives.
Important.
Yeah, yes. I so many positives. Let's talk a little bit as we finish up here. I don't want to take too much of your time about merit. I think you and I are both very, very much in favor of a merit-based achievement. Not just because of the merit side, but because it takes a lot of work to be good at something. And so that says something about work ethic. And of course, the people that succeed versus the people that don't, I'm convinced a lot of it is the people that succeed are willing to work very, very hard to succeed. And I think there's nothing more destructive to a society than to eliminate the work ethic, the merit-based achievement. But specifically when it comes to admissions, you know, I looked up some statistics, and it turns out that 10 to 15% of public colleges and universities nowadays, only 10 to 15% require a test score. I mean, it's shocking what has happened to that compared to the era of when I was applying to college. And in fact, only something like 20 or 25% of all schools in the U.S. require an SAT or an ACT score. What are your thoughts on that? And did you see that as being a problem or was irrelevant when you were president at Arizona?
Yeah, our law school was the first law school not to require the LSAT to get into law school. And then subsequently, we abandoned the ACT and SAT requirements. I think, obviously, that there can be some economic or cultural bias to those tests, and some people just don't, you know, do well on a standardized test. I would like to see more of universities go back to it, because, like you said, how are you going to decide who the best and brightest of the students are, without having these tests. It means that you have to study, you have to be rigorous, and
also, to me, the test is an equalizer. On one hand, yes, it can be biased and culturally, or people pay for coaches or whatever.
Yeah.
On the other hand, to me, that's the opportunity for somebody who doesn't have a connection, who doesn't have somebody who's famous writing them letters of reference. These are all very soft things. And by the way, they're giving away A's like crazy in many schools that are in high school. So here you get a guy who says, you know what, I can ace that test. And that's we have countries in the world that do that, like China and India, for instance. But I lean very positive toward requiring the test, not saying the test is the only factor, but I have a tendency to be skeptical of people who are afraid to take a test.
Yeah. And as I said, I'm a big proponent of going back and requiring those tests. We went back to, because one of the things that happened at the University of Arizona is we abolished all of the SAT, ACT, and just simply said, if you had a 4.0, you could come for free. Well, guess what happened? We didn't really budget for it, which got us into some financial shortfalls because we had to pay it out of our reserves. Mm-hmm. But we had, the old show, ABC Wild World of Sports, the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. We suffered from the agony of success because everybody with a 4.0, doesn't matter. I can just tell you, I know where you grew up and I know where I grew up. My 4.0 at my school was not the same as your 4.0. They're not all created equally. And as you said, the whole issue of grade inflation is a big reality. But these people came out of the woodwork. And every time I would ask, why did you come to the University of Arizona? The parents would say, because you gave us the most money to come here. So I wanted to reinstitute and make it even a more selective process. We were well on our way to reforming that when I stepped down as president.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of issues. I think, it sort of reminds me, to wrap up here, of when I was a kid. I was too young to be conscious of what was going on in the 60s, but there were all kinds of, the campus was the center of the front page. In that era, it was the Vietnam War and all these other protests and things. And now we're back to seeing the campus as a center of controversy. And in a lot of ways, I think it's very good, actually, for young people to be involved in challenging issues so that they actually are sort of forced to think by being exposed to these issues. Of course, the solutions to these controversies are quite complicated and difficult. And, maybe your respite from being president of a major university is sort of a good timing. I don't know how you think about that.
Yeah, I'm eager to get back in. There's so many of these jobs that are available right now, and I'm eager to go back and serve again. People look at me and think I'm crazy for saying that, but I think it's the best job in the world. And I relish the opportunity to face adversity, because somebody has to be on these campuses making tough decisions. And
That's right. It
may not be popular, but I think for the good of the institution, for the good of the state, for the good of our country, we need more strong leaders to be in these positions.
Absolutely. And if the good people don't step forward and do these tough jobs, then who's left? Which, of course, is a sort of a depressing thought. So great talking to you, Bobby. Really a pleasure. And thank you for taking the time. Hopefully I'll have you back again.
Okay. Thank you, Scott.
Thank you for listening to Independent Truths with Scott Atlas. If you want to find out more about today's guest, Dr. Bobby Robbins, President Emeritus of University of Arizona, check out his writings and interviews in the media, and watch the news for his next position. And don't forget, subscribe to this show on YouTube, Spotify, Apple, Google, anywhere else you're listening to podcasts right now, and I'll see you next time.